In 2007, John Roberts, Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, declared, "The way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race." Thank you, sir. You truly are a once-in-a-generation legal mind. Roberts then held and subsequently reaffirmed in the affirmative action cases of 2023 that any recognition of race as a characteristic associated with different opportunities or levels of access was discriminatory. The Supreme Court ruled that the only legal way to treat different people is to assume that they're the same. Now, in theory, this sounds nice, right? If we know that race, gender, sexuality, ethnicity, and other protected identities are used to justify discrimination, then certainly we should eliminate our recognition of those identities at all. But this is a perfect example of what Audre Lorde called institutionalized rejection of difference. Here is the Chief Justice of the most august institution of the American government literally rejecting difference, rejecting the very idea that difference is historically, socially, and economically baked into the system and into a person's place in it long before they even reach high school. I'm Tara McMullen, and this is What Works, the show that rethinks work, business, and leadership for the 21st century economy. This is the second episode of a five-part series on decoding empathy. In the first episode, I explored both my personal empathy origin story and the concept's roots in aesthetics. I also looked at how practicing empathy requires a recognition of difference rather than an assumption of sameness. And today's episode examines that idea even more closely by asking a couple of critical questions. How do you get seen in a world that doesn't see you? And how do you get recognized when so many systems are designed to keep you unrecognized? Whether in college admissions, policing, or hiring practices, institutions often seek to cultivate fairness by rejecting difference. And often, this looks like rejecting the idea that people might have different experiences or opportunities based on characteristics like race or gender. It can also look like rejecting anyone whose difference cuts against what's deemed acceptable or normal. Whether society rejects those who are different or rejects the very idea of difference, the effect is invisibility for anyone who doesn't conform to what Lorde calls the mythical norm.
The mythical norm is the central figure around which society and the status quo are built, right? And any deviation from that mythical norm incurs, you know, friction within the system that we all exist within, right?
That's Chloe Nwangwu, a behavioral scientist and brand strategist, as well as the founder of NobiWorks. She works with
movement makers and thought-leading brands who are, for whatever reason, underrecognized and are looking to emerge from the margins. So that's generally who I'm working with. And the work that I do is, honestly, I help make them more visible using science. That's it.
Chloe's work centers on recognizing difference by recognizing the way someone's intersecting identities make it more difficult to be seen. She devises strategies for overcoming invisibility. Not only does the mythical norm act on systems, it acts on us individually. Lorde writes, "Somewhere on the edge of consciousness, there is what I call a mythical norm, which each one of us within our hearts knows that is not me." The mythical norm reminds us of the ways we lack power and visibility. But the mythical norm is also a system of power, the status quo.
And so the mythical norm is generally you're male, you're white, you are thin, you are able-bodied, you are cisgendered, you are straight, you are usually educated, you are usually well off, right? Mm-hmm. All of these things and more make up the mythical norm, right? And so if you are the mythical norm, you don't need to do anything to maintain the status quo, right? And frankly, none of us really need to do anything to maintain the status quo. It's just that the status quo is so poisonous mm-hmm. that often those of us who look at it and see that poison can't do anything but to try to shift that status quo elsewhere.
The more I resemble the status quo, the more I fit within that system of power, the more easily recognized I am. The more someone else can look at me and clock me as not too far off the mythical norm, the more likely they are to tap me for a promotion, take up my idea in a meeting, or simply not assume the worst of me when I walk by them on the street. But the less I resemble the status quo, the more invisible or misrecognized I become, the less likely I am to get the job, attract the followers, or be taken seriously. And that's where Chloe comes in. My first encounter with Chloe's work was her excellent Harvard Business Review essay, Why We Should Stop Saying Underrepresented. In it, she argues that the term underrepresented turns the results of systemic bias into a de facto, that's just the way it is situation.
The way that underrepresented works, right? It is simply a scenario that happens to be the case, right? Like, it just so happens that these folks are underrepresented, right? And like, it's through no actual action on any one particular person or group of people's part, right?
Instead of underrepresented, Chloe suggests the term underrecognized, which reminds us that there's a person or institution that's doing the underrecognizing.
With underrecognition, we have an active doer, right? We know that the person who is underrecognizing is the person who is underrecognizing, right? And so that immediately puts the onus on the person who is underrecognizing to actually go ahead and recognize, right?
Instead of an accepted institutionalized rejection of difference, we get an institutional and personal imperative to recognize difference. In the institutionalized rejection of difference, that legal or policy fiction of sameness, people who cleave to the mythical norm don't have to expend much energy. Empathy isn't so much an act of pursuit as it is a foregone affective conclusion. Recognition, however, requires action. Empathy requires taking an active interest in better understanding a person whose experience differs from your own, which, it should be said, is everyone. Unfortunately, since those who benefit from the mythical norm and status quo power structures aren't used to expending that kind of energy, this requirement can feel like an undue burden. The recognized are ignorant of all the ways that underrecognized people already go out of their way to understand people in power. Or, as Lord put it, oppressors always expect the oppressed to extend to them the understanding so lacking in themselves. The result of underrecognition is often a lack of access to the systems, institutions, and markets that make up society. Access is a complex form of perception, argues disability studies scholar Tanya Tichkowski. The question of access makes us wonder about who is excluded, through what means, and for what purpose. The question of access also leads us to wonder about who is to be included, how inclusion is accomplished, and what the meaning of that inclusion is. Access and recognition are interrelated. There is no access without recognition. And recognition should provoke questions about who has been un- or under-recognized, how that lack of recognition was sustained, and who or what that lack of recognition serves. Chloe's work confronts how lack of recognition is sustained. Her interventions as a brand strategist empower under-recognized individuals by exposing the visibility bias they're subjected to and the visibility taxes that they pay.
That visibility biases and the invisibility tax are two sides of the under-recognition coin, as it were. So for those who are unfamiliar, under-recognition is simply the status or the situation we're in. Certain kinds of folks and their breakthrough ideas or their contributions are overlooked and underappreciated systemically. And so one side of the under-recognition coin is the source of that, the cause of under-recognition, and those are visibility biases, right? And that's why I say that under-recognition is a behavioral challenge, because it is largely activated by these visibility biases. Now, visibility biases are just a subset of cognitive biases that contribute to under-recognition, right? That's really all they are. They're a type of cognitive bias. Like the racial attention deficit, for example, is a great example of a visibility bias. I'm not responsible for naming that one. That actually comes out of some research by Levine et al. And they were able to empirically demonstrate is white Americans are 33% more likely to overlook their Black American peers.
This 2021 study found that white Americans were 33% more likely to overlook input from Black peers than white peers, even when they were incentivized to pay attention. The study's findings show that white Americans, quote, rate Black peers as less competent than white ones and are less likely to follow their example as a guide to making a better decision. Now, when white study participants were given information about their Black peers' credentials or accomplishments, the racial attention deficit persisted, although the gap did close. But it wasn't until the white study participants were able to experience the competency of their Black peers that the deficit closed completely. And that gets to one of the biggest problems with the rejection of difference. If people who traditionally hold power have to experience working alongside peers who are different from them in order to judge them equally competent, then we can't fix discrimination, prejudice, or under-recognition without putting people in the same room. And under-recognized people are far less likely to get put in the same room as people who traditionally hold power. So the only way to fix that is to diversify access. Okay, so that's the visibility bias, or at least an example of it. How about the invisibility tax?
On the flip side of the under-recognition coin, we have the invisibility tax. And the invisibility tax is like a legitimate tax, right? Like when I talk to people, I'm like, we're doing tax evasion, baby. Like we're, it's the good kind. The way that this works is that this is a literal tax on resources, right? Be it time, attention, money, energy, right? All of those things. It is the extra amount of those resources that underrecognized folks are asked by society to pay in order to be visible. And when I say be visible, I mean visible at all. And also to be as visible as their peers, right? Now, a really good example of a facet of the invisibility tax. And when I talk about this, I want folks to like sort of imagine like literally the form for their taxes. I know it's unpleasant, but you know, give me some room here, work with me here, right? And there are little literal tax items, right? And so like if this thing applies to you, you're paying this. If this thing applies to you, you're paying this, right? That's how the invisibility tax works. So a great example of sort of like a facet of the invisibility tax, a line item, as it were, is the ambition penalty. And this is not something, again, that I am responsible for. This term was coined by Stephanie O'Connell Rodriguez. And She defines this as the sum total of costs that specifically women, in her case, are asked to pay for being ambitious, right? Now, I definitely extrapolate this to all underrecognized folks, but in O'Connell's work, it is specifically with women, right? And she names this as sort of where the confidence gap in women and girls comes from, right? That instead of there actually being a confidence gap, it is really women and girls appropriately assessing the situation and understanding that if they come off as ambitious, if they assimilate in that way and try to present themselves in the same way that some of their peers with greater environmental protections, maybe I should say, but you know, really what I mean is privilege, right? If they try to present themselves in the same way, then they will be penalized for it. And so instead, they hold off because that is safer, right? That's the ambition penalty. It is a facet of the invisibility tax, and there are lots of these.
In her essay, Eye to Eye, Audre Lorde writes about the anger she constantly negotiates as a result of existing in a world that hates her, that either renders her invisible or labels her in ways she can't possibly recognize as hers. She writes, quote, "Black women give our children forth into a hatred that seared our own young days with bewilderment, hoping we have taught them something they can use to fashion their own new and less costly pathways to survival." Those costly pathways to survival are part of the invisibility tax, just as much as aphorisms about being twice as good or working twice as hard to gain the same recognition as a mediocre white man. Reflecting on Lorde's essay, Tanya Tichkowski turns to recognition. She writes, "Recognition brings us face to face with the wondrous complexity of perception, of which and to which we are all subject in many different ways." She continues, "The many-sidedness of recognition resides in the complexity of and between every word." The complexity of and between every word can be a lot to navigate, whether you've been excluded or ignored, or whether you're trying to unwind the ways you overlook and underrecognize people who are different from you. But the complexity of and between every word is also an opportunity. We can make those spaces fertile with meaning and possibility. And that's exactly what Chloe does when she practices brand strategy.
There are many definitions of what a brand is, right? Almost as many definitions as there are people to share them. I want folks to imagine with me for a moment a sort of constellation of stars, right? Each star is sometimes connected to other stars in a sort of galaxy, and sometimes stars are like off on their own or they have tinier clusters, right?
The formation of a constellation is imaginative, not scientific. It's a construction of meaning, not physics or math or astronomy.
This constellation that you're now imagining is essentially what memories look like in the human mind, right? The associative memory network.
A brand is to memories as a constellation is to stars. It's an imaginative product of meaning making, and that meaning is designed to influence behavior. In other words, a brand takes a set of memories and directs them in a certain way. Recognition, esteem, value, influence, trust.
But the thing that makes it powerful is that a brand is meant to influence behavior. Otherwise, it's just memories, right? Otherwise, it's just ideas, right?
Okay, so what does this look like in practice?
The best illustration that I can give of this actually comes from some previous experience in my life. Back when I was working in the sort of international conflict resolution space, and at this time, I was brought on as a junior member of a team that was working on the civil war in Yemen. And I didn't know this at the time, right? But the group that had brought us in, they weren't actually a part of the UN peace process. And so as far as the UN and other actors were concerned, they were not involved, even though they were a pretty sizable chunk of the population ethnically, right? And so as somebody who's trained in mediation and conflict resolution, right, we get into this world because we believe, yes, we can level the playing field. We're going to make sure that the peace negotiations themselves, like there are no big guys or small guys, everybody is heard, right? But in this scenario, I was presented with a situation where a group that really should have been at the table in order for the peace settlement to actually be sustainable, to last beyond 5-10 years, a group that should have been in that room wasn't even making it in the door. And so we had to figure out how we were going to get them in the door. And while we were doing that, and as I was sort of thinking, I was like, okay, well, why aren't they even in the door? How, like, what is the thing that allows for, that allows folks to have access versus not, right? And of course, there are ideas of power and everything that are collected here, right?
This is what Tanya Tichkowski calls a politics of wonder. Instead of taking for granted that the group Chloe was working with would be excluded from negotiations, she wondered why they were being excluded. How is access or lack thereof sustained? And who benefits from the group's exclusion? Only by actively wondering about these questions could she or her team design an intervention.
But it's not only the biggest actors who get into some of these rooms, right? It's the folks that you cannot afford to ignore. And after a lot of research, I realized, oh, duh, brands. That's what it is. It's their brand. A brand ultimately teaches others how to treat you. And so everything, every nation state, every sub-actor has a brand, right? That's why you don't make certain moves in the geopolitical space against, let's say, France, right? Or Germany, or even the United States, right? Because you know how they will respond, right? That is part of their brand, right? And so when I had that realization that, oh, okay, it's the brand. The brand is the thing that's doing this. This then allowed me, at least from my own mental framework, to organize how I was going to work on this issue.
Understanding who is excluded, how they're excluded, and why they're excluded certainly illuminates a bad situation. But it also provides a star map for recognition. Yes, it'll take work that shouldn't need to be done, but the end result is a seat at the table.
By the time I separated from that project, they were part of the peace process. So, like, great success everywhere. The thing happened, right? But I think the thing that is the most interesting is the fact that it was the shaping of their brand that actually led to that outcome. And so, when I say that a brand is a system of ideas that influences the behavior of others, this is what I mean. Right? That a brand, no matter what it is attached to, it is informing others how to treat the entity that that brand belongs to. That is how it is influencing behavior.
Who is includable and who is excludable? Where do we draw the boundary around recognition and who has a right to it?
Got this term from Angela Bassett in her recent Oscar acceptance speech. This idea of a circle of recognition.
What I hope this moment means is that we are taking the necessary steps toward a future in which it is the norm, not the exception, to see and embrace one another's full humanity, stories, and perspectives. This must be our goal, and to always remember that there is room for us all. When we stand together, we win together.
Socially and politically, our circle of recognition has deemed many groups of people excludable. For those excluded, the only way to cross the boundary into inclusion is to shed those excludable identities. If you're a woman, behave more like a man. If you're Black, behave more like a white person. If you're fat, lose weight. If you're disabled, don't ever tell people about the extra hurdles you had to go through to even get in the room. Becoming includable has meant erasing or flattening your own differences.
What this sort of flattening of difference is doing is it's meant to ensure a couple of things. One, that you don't have to do a lot of work to invite somebody into your circle of recognition. So that's one. Two, that invitation is conditional. And as long as you assimilate in just the right way, you remain within that circle of recognition. But as soon as you do not, you are no longer in that circle of recognition, right? And again, putting the onus, putting the burden on the under-recognized person to assimilate in that way, right? And also, thirdly, gives folks cause, feelingly genuine cause, to exclude people from their circle of recognition, right? And so it allows folks to do all three of those things while also maintaining the idea that nothing is wrong and that the status quo is fine. And I think that the only way that we get to the kind of world that we're hoping for, the only way that we do that is that we construct circles of recognition that allow for difference and celebrate those differences, right? And again, that is because context matters and the lives that different people have led to different experiences. And those aren't things that folks can or should turn off. It brings us back again to this idea of the invisibility tax, right? That in order to enter the circle of recognition, I have to pay tax over tax over tax over tax. And gosh, wouldn't it just be nice if recognition were tax-free for everyone, not just, you know, the mythical norm.
For an episode that's part of a series on empathy, it was shockingly lacking in mentions of empathy. By my count, I only used the word empathy twice when I wasn't talking about the series itself. But I think that's because the whole conversation was really about empathy. We just used a different vocabulary. And Chloe's vocabulary for talking about recognition, equity, visibility bias, and the pains of invisibility offers a new framework for applying empathy at work. She gives us a practical language that inspires action and imagination. Or, as Audre Lorde put it, quote, "Difference must be not merely tolerated, but seen as a fund of necessary polarities between which our creativity can spark like a dialectic. Difference is that raw and powerful connection from which our personal power is forged."
And so, thus shall it be. So yeah, did we just do world peace?
We did. It's done. All of the guns have been laid down. The planes are landed. It's done.
All conflict is ended. We have solved it here.
Since we have solved world peace, that seems like a good place to end things. Huge thanks to Chloe Nwangwu for generously sharing her experience, expertise, and stories. Find out more about Chloe at nobiworks.com. That's nobiworks.com. My work on subjects like empathy, the self-help industry, and time is possible only because of listeners and readers who chip in as premium subscribers. If you enjoy what works and you want to see this kind of thinking continue, please consider upgrading if you have the means. For just $7 per month, you get access to my premium columns, live quarterly workshops, and discussion threads. Go to whatworks.fyi to upgrade. That's whatworks.fyi. bit.ly. What Works is a production of Yellow House Media, a podcast production agency for people changing the way we think about culture, creativity, leadership, and work. Our production coordinator is Lou Blazer. Our production assistant is Emily Kilduff. This episode was written and edited by me, Tara McMullen. Marty Seafelt is our audio engineer, and Sean McMullen is our fearless leader and executive producer. What Works is produced on stolen land. We're grateful to the Susquehannock and Conestoga peoples who stewarded this land for thousands of years before the arrival of white colonists. The Yellow House is on the unceded land of the Kutanaha Nation and the tribes of the Salish and Kalispell.